All right. Well, welcome back to the IndieVets Happy Hour. I'm your host, Dr. Andrew Heller, DVM. And I'm here as usual with, I always add in DVM because my co-host is not a DVM. She is a
BMD.
Yes, Marissa Brunetti, Dr. Brunetti. We are all remote today, so I'm unfortunately not drinking beer next to Marissa, but I still get to see her on my screen. And we have a special guest today. And today we're going to be continuing in our series. We're doing a Pearls series or a refresher series on lots of different things. We're in season two now. It's 2022. We're trying to come at you once a week instead of twice a month. So definitely keep a watch out for new episodes popping up more frequently than they were. Today, we are going to be talking about hyperthyroidism. If you joined us on our last podcast, it was hypothyroidism, and we had an amazing guest there too. So I suggest you go back and check that one out as well. So Marissa, who do we have here with us today? Who are we excited to introduce?
Well, first, Andrew, thank you. I'm really excited that you introed a VMD as your guest host. I'm going to intro a VMD as our guest today, which
oh my God, I'm outnumbered.
You're really outnumbered. We actually graduated a year apart. But today we have Ellen Bishai, VMD, and who is an associate IndieVet in the Tampa area. And she has, just like me, a very special love for felines. So Dr. Bishai, just give us a brief rundown of like where, when you graduated and what you've been doing since you graduated.
So I went to graduate school before I went to vet school. I got a doctorate in microbiology, so I like germs as well, but only second to cats, of course. I graduated from Penn in 2012, and since then I came back to the Tampa Bay area. I worked at a corporate clinic as my first job, learned a few things there, spent majority of my time in private practice after that. First practice, I was there for a little over 5 years. It was traditional small animal, dogs and cats. And then for about a year and a half, almost 2 years, I worked at a cat exclusive clinic, which was pretty fantastic. Learned a lot about this magical, intricate, confusing little creature we call cats. And then I joined IndieVets in August of 2020. And I've been enjoying that since. And I really like disseminating cat knowledge. So.
Yes. Yeah. You are our resident feline expert, which I appreciate. So,
which I will never use that title, but okay.
Too bad. I call you that anyway. So, but obviously we love cats. Hyperthyroidism is a very common endocrine disease in cats. And I honestly think every cat gets it. It's usually at the top of my differential list. So I will say to you, you know, we talk about this in the beginning of every pod, but it's like, who is this intended for, right? And obviously it's intended for veterinarians, general practitioners who want to brush up on this, but who else could this benefit by listening to hyperthyroidism in cats?
I think owners, especially cat owners, because they're pretty in tune with their cats, but obviously just logging onto the big wide internet is not always the best way to figure things out. And I think if more owners kind of knew the signs of hyperthyroidism to look for, we could, in some cases, diagnose them earlier. I definitely have had clients who, when I see the weight loss and I see the decreased muscle tone, and I'm really pushing for blood work, oh no, but she's doing fine. She's eating really great. She acts like she's a kitten, mm-hmm. you know, that when there's nothing else going on, and that's what we get. And I feel like in some cases, unless we have a client who's either had a cat who's had it before or knows someone who knows something about the disease, we're not catching them until a little bit later. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that can have side effects on other organs. And so I think owners, definitely veterinary technicians, just so they understand what we're doing, I really think it's important for us, even as veterinarians, not to necessarily go into the nitty gritty, but we should empower our vet techs to know what we're doing and why. Not that
they want to learn too.
I think it's a great point because people notice when their cats aren't eating, but in hyperthyroidism, they're typically eating, right? And so they don't think anything is truly wrong. So I think that's a really good point. And cats are mysterious.
The last podcast, we were talking about how everybody comes in thinking their dog has hypothyroidism, right? They're fat. Everybody knows that. But with cats, it's like people don't even realize there's this disease at all.
Right. Yeah. And that's true too. A lot of humans, it's more hypothyroidism. So that's the one that people are familiar with. So even sometimes when I mention hyper, they're like, oh, hypothyroidism? And I'm like, well, no, this is the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
So obviously we know cats get this disease, but what age range or like when are you typically going to see this show up?
Because it's cats and they never follow the rules, I would say almost any age could potentially be possible. But generally, we're talking middle age to seniors. The youngest cat I've ever diagnosed was 5.
Wow. Yeah.
The oldest cat that was newly diagnosed was like 16.
Wow. Okay. Awesome. And briefly just give us an overview of it. I mean, it seems self-explanatory, but, you know, what is this disease process of hyperthyroidism?
Yeah. So the thyroid gland is the gland in our body that I kind of think of as the foreman, kind of regulates a lot of what the organs are doing. And so if and when this organ develops either like usually a functional tumor of some kind, we're going to get a lot more hormone than our body needs. And as one wonderful vet I used to work with who had the best analogies of all time once said, if you're revving your engine and you're just revving your engine for a second to pass, you know, grandma on the interstate, you're going to get the, you know, your revs going into the red, but it'll be fine. You're going to come right back down. If those revs are staying in that red zone, you're going to burn your engine into the ground. So what I try to, because I definitely have clients who, when you explain it to them, like, oh, you're an overactive thyroid. Oh, what's the big deal? And I try to use that analogy that eventually we're going to burn the organs into the ground.
Yeah.
They are overworked, especially the heart. It can progress things like kidney disease, which I would say that's the one every single cat pretty much gets.
Yep.
Because it has such far-reaching side effects, you know, that I think that's why it's important. But essentially, usually a tumor develops, one or more. It's a cat. They can do whatever they want on the thyroid gland, and they're usually functional tumors.
Right. Yeah. And it's not cancer for you, for all the non-vets out there listening. It's not cancer.
Hyperplasia, let's say.
Yes. So obviously for those people listening, they hear the word tumor, and we'll make it clear that most of these tumors are not, you know, metastatic. They're not malignant.
Well, there's the rare one,
true.
But yeah.
Awesome. All right, cool. So most importantly, what is a cat going to look like when they show up and they have hyperthyroidism? What are some things you can see clinically?
The common cat, not the only way they can present. A lot of times, like I said earlier, because some owners just don't know what to look for. The most common presentation I see, lots of muscle wasting. Usually they're dehydrated. Usually if there's no other concurrent morbidities, which that's another fun thing cats like to do, they're usually pretty bright and alert.
Yep.
You know, you would expect them to be dehydrated and feeling kind of down, but they're not. They're very chatty, mm-hmm. very chatty and vocal. And the coat is usually, I don't see flaking typically, but it's unkempt.
Yeah.
It's not, and it's a difficult, I can't describe it as greasy. It's just not that normal, nice, shiny coat that we would see. But I have definitely diagnosed hyperthyroidism in overweight cats.
Yeah.
The biggest thing I always see is like losing weight and eating a lot. Just that's the complaint from the owner. Used to be fat and, you know, all of a sudden he's skinny.
Right. We get that too. Right. Like he used to be 16 pounds and now he's like down to like 9. Yeah. And a lot of times at that point they're vomiting.
Yep.
And usually caterwauling at all hours of the night. And the owners can't sleep. So that's usually when they present.
I was going to say, they usually bring them in when they're like, why do you want to eat so much? Why are you so annoying to me right now? What's going on? Yes. So that's a good one. All right. So how are we going to diagnose this?
So as with just about any feline illness, blood work is the starting point. My preference is, and I don't think there's, for me, much leeway on this, and the American Association of Feline Practitioners concurs. CBC chemistry, a T4 and a free T4, I think is very helpful. I usually do that regardless, even if the cat's not showing clinical signs, and a urinalysis. Mm-hmm. I don't think any part of that is really negotiable to be very fair and honest.
Yeah. So what are some things, obviously you're going to see a high total T4 in the most obvious ones, right?
Yeah.
But what if you see, we all hear about this gray zone, right? Of the T4, which is so annoying. But like, what would you do if you got a T4 in the gray zone and the cat had all these clinical signs to support hyperthyroidism?
if we didn't initially send out the free T4 in the panel. And that's, to be honest, that's one of the main reasons I'll send out the free T4 within the original panel, so that I don't have to call the owner and say, hey, I need you to pay more money so I can add on this additional test. But that's the first thing I try, is sending out the free T4. And there's categories of the disease. Like if both of them are not elevated, then obviously that's not your culprit. If the total T4 is mid-range, the gray zone, but the free T4 is high or significantly high, they do usually recommend to treat.
Okay.
I've seen cases where, you know, some cats are kept a little hyperthyroid to keep the kidney numbers normal, even though I do feel like in that case, we may be tricking ourselves. Because just because the numbers look fine, it doesn't mean the kidney disease isn't progressing. But there are definitely ranges of where you want the T4. For me, I'll be very honest, if it's a cat with the clinical signs, if that total T4 is higher than like 2.3, 2.4, I'm usually going to say I need a free T4 just to rule it off.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just want everyone to know who can't see Ellen, she put quotes around.
I was going to say that. Actually.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yes, I'm very visual.
No, I think it's great that, you know, you put quotes around like to keep the kidneys healthy, because obviously it's a common misconception that like being hyperthyroid is healthy for the kidneys, where that's a misnomer, right? Like obviously it can, you know, shield.
It
can mask kidney disease because of the increased blood flow to the kidneys, but that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, that the kidneys aren't, their disease isn't progressing. So I think that's a very good point.
There was one extra thing I was going to say as far as diagnostics, and I do think blood pressures are important too, because kidney disease is one of the ones where the blood pressure will go up, but also with hyperthyroidism, and that's something that you're probably going to end up monitoring, hopefully, as you monitor the, you know, response to treatment. So having a baseline from day one is super important. And I obviously, if there's clinical sign, you know, physical exam findings where you think an X-ray is needed for something else, you know, just to look at things, that's obvious, that would be indicated. But usually, obviously, the only way we're going to actually really see the thyroid if we want to image is an ultrasound.
Yeah. Are you always going to feel a thyroid slip in cats that are hyperthyroid?
No, absolutely not. And I'll be very honest, I feel like I've only ever felt it twice that I could say, yes, I definitely felt. I'll just be very honest. Maybe I'm terrible at it. But unless it's a noticeable nodule on that thyroid gland, there's several cats that I never feel it on them.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to bring it up. So I'm glad that you said that, because people think, oh, you can't possibly be hyperthyroid, I can't feel your thyroid. And that is not the case at all.
I feel like the one thing I tell all cat owners, and I kind of use as a rule for myself, is the only rule all cats are going to follow is they don't follow the rules. So
it's true.
It really doesn't matter if you have 1 out of 10 signs, or if you have 9 out of 10 signs, if you have even an inkling of suspicion, you're not going to know unless you definitively rule it out. That's just the way they are.
Can we go back to checking blood pressures on cats?
No,
cats with hyperthyroidism and checking blood pressures. Tell us your pearls of wisdom on that one.
So obviously it's tough. I've read certain reports that say even when a cat is stressed in the clinic, like the systolic should not jump higher than like 10. I still think that's a big range. In my clinic, when I worked at the cat clinic, obviously, if we were going to check blood pressure, is the first thing we checked. Ideally, we'd have a carrier where you could take the top off. The cat is still in the bottom half. We know they're already a little nervous, but they're not like flailing or anything like that. And obviously, if they're uncomfortable in lateral recumbency, tails, I feel like most of the times can be tricky for cats. Like I sometimes get readings that are super different on the tail than a forelimb or a hind limb. So I'm not saying I've never used it, like when the cat is just super sensitive, but I kind of take it with a grain of salt. Obviously, a quiet room, hopefully without a dog barking nearby. Feel away towels blocking their view. And then in the cases when we absolutely know the cat is either petrified or becomes fractious, our clinic did have a smaller blood pressure machine that we would sign out to the clients and they'd have to return. Basically, they were told if it's not returned within, I think it was 48 hours, they would be charged the price of the
machine.
So you weren't using a Doppler on those then?
No. To be just fair, a lot of the clinics I worked at didn't use Doppler.
Yeah.
I liked that in vet school, and I do think it makes me feel much more confident in the reading. But obviously, that's another step. Shaving the fur off the paw, holding the paw, the sound of the Doppler, putting the gel on their paw. So I would say in clinical practice, I've maybe only used a Doppler a handful of times. It's usually an oscillometric.
Okay. Is that like the PetMap one, or do you actually have like a Cardell?
It was a Cardell that we used to hand out, but you know, the one that's portable, not the one that's
on the stand.
Mounted on the stand.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent. Yeah. Blood pressure in cats is tough. I want to do it. I want to do it all the time, but I'm just like,
I know.
Yeah. And here's another question. So I never know. I go back and forth on this. You think the cat has hyperthyroidism. It's hypertensive. Do we just start treating the hyperthyroidism, or do we simultaneously?
First.
Yes. Okay. So you aren't starting.
I always do that first. Okay. That's why I want that baseline.
Yeah.
The last thing I would ever want is to make an actually normotensive cat, give them low blood pressure.
Right.
So it's important, but that's part of the discussion I have is, hey, the first thing we have to do is basically get that foreman in line, you know, and then we'll see if the workers follow. And then if for some reason this is not resolved, it's kind of similar. Like when I see occasionally on lab work, I'll see an elevated ALT and I'll explain to owners, this could be the liver being overworked. And I would expect that if that's the case, as we correct the thyroid, this should resolve on its own. And if it doesn't, then we know there's something more going on, but we've got to get that primary problem addressed first. And in most cases, at least the ones that get presented to me, they're not in a situation where there's anything life-threatening.
Yeah.
Obviously, if there was, we would probably treat simultaneously. But for the most part, these cats are clinically doing pretty well, getting the thyroid under control and then circling back.
Unless, like, the systolic is 180, 190, 200, something like that. Like if we're just at 160, 170, maybe like 175, the lower end, I tend to wait until we recheck the blood pressure after we've started methimazole or started treatment for hyperthyroidism. And so if the hypertension resolves, then I'm less concerned. However, if it's at the higher end, then I definitely would start something like a quarter of a 2.5 milligram of amlodipine, either once a day or twice a day, kind of based on level of suspicion, how big the cat is, just so we make sure that we're not, even if it is transient, that we're not going to cause any damage to the retina or anything like that. And obviously, as we correct the thyroid, just to adjust the dose accordingly with subsequent blood pressure measurements. But that's usually the way I tackle that issue.
That makes total sense. If you're like, oh, by the way, you need to give your cat like multiple pills. Like that would be so fun. No, no, thanks.
That's game over.
Game over.
You're jumping ahead.
Yeah, I know. So, all right. So treatment. So most common treatments and then some other options that, you know, people can do as well.
Yeah. So once we've confirmed that it's definitely hyperthyroidism, so there is, I would say, even amongst the feline practitioners, like two groups. There's the ones that think if there's absolutely no signs of kidney disease, which for me, I take the blood pressure into account, but I feel one of the absolute most important things is the USG on the urinalysis. And that is a big reason why I really think that that is indispensable from your initial workup. Because it's not going to be affected unless the cat is super polydipsic and they just drank like a ton of water before they came to the vet. That's going to be pretty darn accurate.
Okay.
And then that way you can have that conversation with the owner of there is a chance that your cat is already in kidney disease. We will determine the degree after we correct the thyroid and we'll address that. But if I have a cat whose USG is like 1050,
yeah,
you know, I always tell them that you never say never, but it looks like we shouldn't have any other complications with the kidneys when we're treating. But so a lot of vets, if they feel the kidneys are fine, they a lot more are leaning more towards doing radioactive iodine because that's a definitive treatment. That's we're curing the disease. In most cases, I've had cats who need a second treatment. I had one case where a cat needed three treatments.
Wow.
To get, yeah.
There's actually a local metropolitan here will actually guarantee that it works. So if you do it the first time and it doesn't work, they'll do it the second time for free. And I know 95% of the time it's usually curative in the first one.
Yes. And it's obviously it's cats and things can progress. But I still feel like for me, I will usually start with methimazole as my treatment. The one thing that I've sometimes seen some vets do, and again, this is not to be disparaging or anything, but just from what I've seen in cats, if I see a cat who has a T4 of 7.0 and I see a cat who has a T4 of 4.1, I'm still going to start them on 2.5 milligrams twice a day. Yeah. I think some of us still think in terms of quantity, not quality. I just never know. It's not 1 + 1 = 2. It's not linear. So yeah. I never know how cat A is going to respond to methimazole or how cat B is going to respond to methimazole. So, and I think it's very important with the clients, and I do this with all of them. I prepare them that we don't know how your cat's going to respond. It is always better to start low and work our way up so we don't cause any other problems that we don't want. And what that means is you're going to see me again in 3 to 4 weeks, sooner if there's a problem. And if that dose is not enough, we're going to tweak it again. And you're going to see me again in 3 to 4 weeks. So until we have our dose, you are going to be seeing me more often. We're going to be checking. And I tell them what we're checking. You know, every time there's a dose change, 3 to 4 weeks after the dose change, we're going to recheck. And then once we're stable, I will see you 3 months after that to monitor progress. And some owners take that well. Some owners still are like a little resistant in the beginning, but I feel the more you prepare them, the less you are going to be fighting and regulating that cat, because they're the ones who have to get the cat in a carrier and bring the cat in. Yep. They're the ones who have to do the medicine at home, and they need to be your allies.
Yeah.
So I still start with methimazole, and I've learned there would be the odd one where if it's like just over and the cat weighs like 5 pounds, then I may say, okay, let's try 2.5 milligrams once a day in the morning. I tell the owner technically the medicine is designed to be an every 12-hour medicine, but some cats can be well managed on once a day.
That was going to be one of my questions. So I'm on the same page as you. I always do 2.5 milligrams twice a day to start, no matter how what the number of the T4 is, because of the side effects. So what sort of side effects can you see in cats, like in the very beginning of treatment?
So for me, thankfully, like I, especially at the cat clinic, we used flimazole. So side effects were pretty rare.
Oh, good.
Obviously, GI upset is just pick a cat, any cat, give it a pill.
Yeah.
GI upset's on your list.
True.
Facial excoriations is the one that's described the most, where they get this terrible, they're itching their face and it's all scabby in their head. I've only, my personal experience, surprisingly, I think I've only seen that like once in a cat. I really don't see it super often. Those are the main ones. I've seen some where they will have decreased appetite, but it's usually sometimes they'll vomit, and then sometimes they won't vomit. They just don't want to eat because their tummy hurts or bothers them.
I totally agree. My own personal cat, Gus, had hyperthyroidism, and he had the facial excoriations. And I was like, of course you would.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. All right. So twice a day. And that's another question that I thought was a really good point. I was always taught twice a day too. Maybe you said this already, but can you use it once a day? Like, why would someone use it once a day?
The only time I'll use it once a day. So like if I lived in a perfect world, I would compound it to the dose that we could do twice a day and not go too low. I have had cases where if I have the cat on 2.5 milligrams twice a day, and then I do 2.5 milligrams one, you know, then it gets too low. And I've had the rare case, and these are usually really small cats. I've had the rare case where I do 1.25 milligrams twice a day and they still go too low. And in those cases, I'll just do like, okay, we'll do the 1.25 once a day. I will never start with it once a day.
Yeah.
There may be a few cases where I might say, okay, I'm going to do 1.25 to start with twice a day because I think 2.5 might be a little high. But I think the only time I go to once a day is, and I'll just be honest, I guess we don't know what's happening overnight, you
right.
know,
true.
But most clients are not going to go and compound something that's like point or whatever, you know,
right.
twice a day. And if for me, as long as the cat is gaining weight, clinically looking better, blood work is looking fine, and they're managed on the once a day dosing because the twice a day dosing is making them too low, then, you know, I always, and I do think it's important to keep the clinical picture in mind
too,
like how the whole cat is looking.
You may have already answered this, but for the technicians listening, you know, they're usually the ones that are scheduling the blood checks, like the rechecks. Is there a specific time of the day that you recommend?
I was just asked this yesterday.
Yeah.
By a technician. So what I was taught is the way that methimazole works, it's essentially blocking the iodine from binding the thyroid hormone to make it active. We're not supplementing with any kind of hormone. The thyroid is still making the hormone. It's just not making active hormone because we don't get that binding. I've talked to several internal medicine specialists about this, and the majority of them say with cats, it really shouldn't matter when you check. I mean, I would say for me, I'd at least want an hour or two after so we know that it's been metabolized. But the most important thing for me is that the cat's getting the medicine consistently for 3 to 4 weeks. If I have a client who's, well, I went out of town for a week and the cat didn't get their medicine, I'm like, well, you will restart and see me again in 2 or 3 weeks. That, I think, is more important versus the way the dog's medication works is we're kind of supplementing, you know? So that, I think, is a little more important.
Okay.
When I worked at the cat clinic, we didn't have a time frame for a thyroid.
Yeah.
Honestly, in my clinic, when I wasn't working at the cat doctors, we would still tell the receptionist anything to do with thyroid to schedule 4 to 6 hours post because we didn't want them getting confused.
That makes sense.
And then a dog owner comes in three hours later. And so that way it was just streamlined.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's wrong to do the 4 to 6 hours, but I've never heard one say, make sure it's within that 4 to 6 hour.
That's good to know.
Yeah. Awesome. I was also thinking, so when we're monitoring, other than the T4, what else are you recommending to monitor or do at each of these appointments?
This may sound like overkill to some vets, but I'm honestly at every unless it's something where we're still in the monitoring phase. So like, say we're still adjusting the dose, I may tell an owner, I'm going to check a T4 in-house. If it's still above 2.5 or still above 3, I'm going to adjust your dose and we're going to come back. It's not wrong to say I'll check a T4 and if the T4 is okay, then we'll send out or do the rest of the blood work. But I'm not really negotiable on this unless the owner declines it. Is I'm checking a CBC, a chemistry, a T4. I may not do the free T4 in the right, you know, the checkups, and I'm checking a urine.
And a blood pressure.
And the blood pressure.
Well, you're doing the CBC. Hold on. You're doing the CBC because you're looking at the white cell count and the platelet count, correct? I mean, there could be some changes.
There could be some changes. Part of it, too, for me, and I rarely, unless there's something else going on with the cat, rarely see other changes in the CBC. But to be honest, most of the labs we're going to use, the CBC is going to be included, and it's going to be much more expensive to do a la carte than it is just another panel. So.
What if there are financial concerns? What's like the bare minimum above just a T4, which we know we can always just do a T4.
Yeah.
What is like the bare minimum for checking in these cats, you think?
You know, I've seen some clinics who have separate charges for partial UAs. At minimum, I think a USG is important to monitor. With the thyroid, my bare minimum basic, if it was me, would be a BUN, creatinine, USG, and the thyroid, if you could do like a renal panel.
Yeah.
If it's possible, like say the clinic has pre-anesthetic, you know, short blood work, I do think it's a good idea to check the ALT too.
Yeah.
Especially if there were changes prior to starting, just to monitor that, make sure that's getting better. But I would say for me, because of just how common it is, that would be my bare minimum, is the renal values, the USG, and the thyroid. And obviously the other big thing is the cat should be gaining weight.
Yes.
If the cat is doing better and the owners are describing the appetite is getting more normal, she's not harassing me every time I go in the kitchen, like I can sleep through the night now, then that cat should be gaining weight. And if they're not, that's when we have to explore what else does the cat have.
What else? It's an old cat. It could have so many things. No, that's a great point. I know some of the labs, which I love, they have like a hyperthyroid monitoring panel.
Yes.
Which I really like if people can't do the full thing. So
yes.
I think that hits everything that you were talking about.
I think it's important to work with owners. And I've definitely had cases where the best I can do is just check a T4 SDMA. I don't like hanging everything on the SDMA. Even the feline practitioner says sometimes you can use that as a guidepost. The more values that you have, the better. Obviously, if you have a cat who's clinically doing super well and you just do like a T4 SDMA, then I'm much less concerned.
Yeah.
But if we're not gaining weight or he's still vomiting or whatever it is, then those are the times where I always work with owners. There has to be something we can do. Those are the times that I really think that's why I have my standard, which is full chemistry.
Yeah. No, I mean, in an ideal world, yes, they would. They would have all of that. And so, which is a good transition to, like, let's finish up just briefly talking about hyperthyroid cats that likely will develop kidney disease or already have it. You know, what other things may you be doing? What sort of pearls do you have for managing both of those diseases?
If I have a cat who, like, when we diagnosed, has a USG of 10-15, I'm going to start talking to the owner about, at minimum, we're going to be transitioning your cat to a kidney diet. And I think it's important for owners. I've run into this a lot where we give them the one diet, the cat doesn't like it, so the owner just stops feeding it. Mm-hmm. I let them know, I'm going to start with this because most cats like it. If your cat hates it, you can return it. And there are several other options we can consider. Usually my progression is prescription kidney diet. If they don't like any of them, which most cats will eat the Purina. Most of them will.
Interesting.
Yeah. But if they absolutely will not eat any of the prescription diets, then one of the, and I think Royal Canin still makes this, but one of my other favorite diets is the Royal Canin Senior Consult for cats. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a catch-all for, like, okay, it's not a kidney diet, but it's much better than senior food. It's not a liver diet, but it's, you know, it's not a diabetic diet, but there's a lot of, like, midway things that, like, okay, it's not ideal, but it's...
What's that one called?
It's called Senior Consult.
Senior Consult.
It's their line of veterinary exclusive wellness diets. So it's a senior wellness diet, but I do think of it kind of as like a catch-all. When I have a diabetic cat who won't eat MD, won't eat GlycoBalance, won't eat WD, I would rather them be on that than be on an over-the-counter senior food. But that would be my last tier then would be, okay, at the very least, I want you on an over-the-counter senior food and preferably one that has clinical trials behind it. But I will recommend, like, if you do something like Royal Canin Senior, at least I know that they're taking into account, like, the organs are aging and need, you know, just a little love.
Yeah.
The one thing I think is a good pearl, though, for veterinarians is if you get a cat that you diagnose as hyperthyroid, but that cat is dumpy or that cat is, unless, like, it's super advanced hyperthyroid, if they're not wanting to eat, there's almost always something else going on, like GI disease or something. So I always think it's important that just because we fix the thyroid and all the numbers on our blood work looks good, they should want to eat. These cats, if nothing else is going on, these cats want to eat. They will eat you out of house and home. So if the owner is like, oh, he's losing weight, he's really not doing much, he's just hanging around, I do start to get concerned that there's something more. And I'd start to prepare and I was like, well, let's fix this first and then we'll see how he does. But if he's not getting better, there may be some other things we might need to look into.
Yeah.
I had a clarifying question. So before you mentioned when you would do the radioactive iodine treatments, and you said that you would do it if the cat didn't have any renal disease and was young, right?
I didn't say young, but I'm kind of glad you brought it up because there was something I forgot to mention. I've had cats who are 16 and their USG is 1050.
Okay, so it's mostly about the renal function.
For me, the only cases I've had where I've broken that rule is, like, I had a client who, and most of the times my clients, the only reason they won't do it is cost, you know, so that I understand. But if it's an option, like if cost, you know, money is no object, I do think it's something. If their USG is like 1030, I'm kind of like, let me just see what happens when we use the methimazole. And even the feline practitioners say, if you're not sure, if you've done monitoring and you're correcting the thyroid and consistently those kidney values and the USG are fine, then you can consider it. But the other thing I had a client once who was taking care of a stray cat. And she just was a client who had a heart of gold. And she's like, well, there's no way I can't even do transdermal medicine in this cat. So, and I thought the cat might have maybe some early kidney, but she's like, either the thyroid's going to kill him or the kidney's going to kill him, you know? And so they did radioactive iodine for obvious reasons.
And you raise a good point there too. We didn't really talk about transdermal treatments, but for cat owners out there who are afraid to pill your cat, they do make these drugs in an ointment that you can rub on their ear, actually, and it just goes right across their skin, transdermal, and it works pretty well.
Yep. I just tell owners and it comes with instructions, wear gloves just in case, because it's meant to be absorbed through the skin.
But there's an applicator, so you don't even really put it on your finger or anything.
You're not supposed to.
Yeah.
But things happen. The only other comment I had on the radioactive iodine, why I sometimes shy away from it, I've had a few cases, like a handful, when I was at the cat doctor's, where we can make them hypothyroid. It doesn't happen super often, but I always tell every owner, the majority of the time, this is just going to cure the thyroid. But there are a few cases where you may end up having to give your cat a different pill for the rest of its life.
Yeah, overcorrection.
My other cat, whose name is Teddy, is also hyperthyroid.
It's always the veterinarians, right? or the vet techs. I had a cat who had heartworm, for crying out loud.
Yeah, we're the worst.
Lived through it, but yeah, we always get the, like, I'm always like, why can't you just get hyperthyroidism? Why do you have to get both types of GI cancer at the same time? Like, why can't you be a normal cat?
No, there's no such thing. You said it yourself. But
I know. But so your cat was overcorrected.
My cat was overcorrected and he got fat and his hair got terrible. And so now he's on levothyroxine. So that's great. And he's doing better though, but he's fine. So it does happen. Make sure to warn your clients.
Yes, I do let them know. The only other thing, so the feline practitioners mentioned, like, in some cases you want to check like a TSH. I think that's a little overkill unless you're concerned.
Yeah.
The only time I ever used a TSH in a cat was in a, which they mentioned this in their paper, but I swear I had no idea this existed until I came across the case. Dwarfism in cats is a sign of congenital hypothyroidism. Mm-hmm. So I once diagnosed hypothyroidism in a cat and we put her on levothyroxine and she grew a few inches.
Wow.
Not that much though, I'm sure.
That's an interesting case. You don't see that often.
Yeah. For me, I'd never had another one. Even the cat doctors at the clinic who'd been there for several years were like, really?
Wow.
But she was like 8 or 9 months old and she was just acting weird and her owner was like, do everything. So we did x-rays and her growth plates looked a little open. I was like, that's weird. Why would her growth plates be open at 9 months old? And there was nothing weird on her lab work, but I called the internal medicine specialist, like at IDEX, that was the lab we used. And they looked at it and they're like, that's weird. Why are her growth plates open? I'm like, right? Why? You know? And she's like, have you considered hypothyroidism? And I'm like, why would I consider hypothyroidism? Yeah, it's a cat.
Not at all.
And she's like, oh yeah, that's a cause for dwarfism. Lo and behold, that lady, that owner was like the sweetest. It was one of those cases that's like, this is why I do what I do.
Yeah.
Ellen, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a lot of fun to have you on and you're a wealth of knowledge and you're definitely welcome on again.
Yes. Thank you so much, Ellen. It has been amazing to have you on the pod. Once again, tell all your friends about this podcast. It's definitely short enough to listen to on your commute, especially if you're an associate indie vet. Please review and or comment and make sure to subscribe so you can be alerted whenever we have a new episode. Right now for season 2, we are trying to come at you every week. Thanks, everyone. Cheers.
And be nice to cats.
Be nice to cats.